You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello and welcome to episode 2 of Woodman Corner, the West Bromwich Albion podcast brought to you by Albion fans at the Birmingham Mail. My name's Graham Brown. Usually I'm joined by Joe Chapman, but unfortunately, despite being a man in his early 20s, he's hurt his back. But fear not, there's no shortage of expert views and West Bromwich Albion fans, not least the man sat next to me here now, Steve Freeth, who's a betting guru from Bet365. We're going to talk to Steve. Asking the same questions we ask everyone who comes on. Every week we're going to get fans and players and staff, and we're going to talk to them every time about their favourite stories about West Bromwich Albion. So we'll get onto that in a bit with Steve. But this week we are taking a bit of a veer away. It's hard to ignore the fact at the moment that Tony Pulis is under a lot of pressure at West Bromwich Albion. So today's podcast is going to take a dispassionate view as to whether Tony Pulis is the right man for West Bromwich Albion right now. It's been a good ride recently. I think we've all got a lot to thank Tony Pulis for, but it's hard to ignore that there's a tremendous amount of pressure on the manager that's currently emanating from social media. So we're going to look at this in three ways. I'm going to have a chat with Steve here at the moment, in a moment, about what the odds say, how it's changed. He's very close to the statistics around football and the Albion in particular as a fan, so we'll talk about that. He also knows Tony Pulis a bit. I've talked to Martin Lawrence, who's one of the principal data analysts looking into football in the country, to have a statistical look at how Albion have been performing. And finally, we will talk to Martin Spinks, who's perhaps the journalist that's worked most closely with Tony Pulis across his career as a Stoke City reporter at the Sentinel, and he'll give his view about Pulis. But we'll start now with Steve Freeth. Tell us your favourite story about West Bromwich Albion.
Well, I've got a few, but I don't want to bore you too much. First game was late 70s, 79 Albion, nil, Derby nil. So you could only ever get better.
Stormer.
Yes, Stormer. But in my teens, I did have an obsession, with the Albion. And I still have now, but a bit to a lesser extent. But autographs, writing to players was a massive part of mine, and I've got still have many autographs, signed photos particularly. But when Don Goodman signed, I remember writing to him and having a bit of contact with him, and he was absolutely fantastic. We used to exchange birthday cards and Christmas cards, which is sounds a bit corny now, but it was particularly at the time was absolutely unbelievable. Such a Goodman fan like myself. And we actually had a 24-hour sponsored hockey event at our school, so I ended up just writing to Don, just on the chance of him trying to come over, not expecting any reply at all. But you have to remember, this is the days before internet or anything like that. The late 80s wasn't a great deal, anything like that. But I remember the phone ringing one afternoon, and my mum saying, "Steve, it's Don Goodman on the phone for you," and kind of going, "Yeah, okay," like that. And lo and behold, it was Don, and he wanted to come to the school and open the event, which he did, and had a few photos with him. It was absolutely, great, and it was such a, for a massive Albion fan like I was back then, for him, your hero, to actually come to your school and open an event was like that, and I'll be ever grateful for him. I have seen him since on quite a number of times, and I did see him last year at Royal Ascot. And he'd had a glass of champagne or two, but he certainly remembered it and enjoyed taking the mickey at me a little bit for writing to him as a kid. But he's a great bloke, Don, and I've even forgiven him, Dingle Don, for joining Wolves.
I'm glad you took him to task for that issue. His career veered off him, as far as I'm concerned, after the late 80s. You've obviously seen a fair bit of Albion. What are the memories that last with you?
Yeah, well, Bristol Rovers away was a bad one. Of course, being relegated. I actually went there in a toga. I remember my mate driving down his Brown Marina. Travelling in style in a toga in a Brown Marina. Yeah, it doesn't get any better than
that. And then driving back in it.
Then driving back. It was a, horrendous day. Of course, it was pretty sad, and it was a bad time at the club. And I've only ever, those days you think about it, used to save up, used to have a couple of paper rounds, used to do two every day, and used to save up your money just to watch Albion. I had a season ticket. 86-87 was the first time I had one, and the away games that you used to go, you used to travel on the Hawthorne away travel service, Hats as it was known as, or if you wanted to travel in style, you'd pay the extra pound and go with Dave Mammoth Holloway, Mammoth Tours as it was known then, playing a five for Plymouth away and stuff like that. But I do remember Bradford a bit later on, of course, where Igor Ballas's penalty. And I'll have to admit that I was living in London, and then I left early. I left with a couple of minutes. I've never told anyone this before. I left a couple of minutes early, and there was a bit of a roar as I went past the Bradford end, and I ended up running to the concourse and watching it on a TV monitor. I was actually at the game. Missed one of the greatest events ever of West Bromwich Albion history, and I was a little bit annoyed with myself about that, but you just carry on with these things.
I must segue onto your kids' names. You have four children. Go on, share us the story.
Yeah, four children. The eldest one, I didn't try to get an Albion name in there. The second one, her name is Willow Biamba, which is WBA. Of course, so I managed to get that in. Then Mrs. give it the okay. The third one, we've managed to get the Hawthorne in there, and the last one we had 10 months ago. His middle name's Brom, so we managed to get Brom in there. And I'll have to admit this as well. Obviously, working for the Coates family, that Willow WBA is going to be mascot actually for the Stoke West Brom game on the 23rd. But she's going to be mascot for Stoke. No, I don't know how that's going to go down. I'm okay with it, but I might get a little bit of stick for admitting that that Willow's going to be a mascot for Stoke City against West Brom.
I think on behalf of Albion fans, I think we're glad that you're getting the WBA reference higher up in the programme. That's to your credit. Well, that Stoke link probably segues us next to the next thing. So, like I said, what I want to do today is take a bit of a dispassionate look about the issue of Tony Pulis. We put out a poll on our Twitter account at Woodman Podcast this week. 267 people took part. So we asked people whether or not what they want to happen with Tony Pulis. This is not scientific research, I'm sure West Bromwich Albion would like us to say. 66% said he should go now. 15% said give him till Christmas. 9% said till the end of the season. And just 10%, 1 in 10 people, said he should stay. Now, like I say, Albion fans are struggling with the football they're seeing now. They're not seeing a great quality of football, and the results are starting to drive. But I think what's important is to take a more kind of dispassionate look at this. And you're a man that's kind of that kind of sees the numbers. So starting with the sack race, I guess. Where is he now? Have the odds changed?
Yeah, I mean, at the start of the season, it was always going to be a big price, just because you'd be signing contract extensions, and people were thinking, well, he's not going to be going anywhere anytime soon, really. But of course, that's all changed with the recent form that they've had, and it is a little bit worrying where Tony is currently. Second favourite behind Silva, of course, because Silva's been linked with the Everton job currently, hasn't he, as well? So he is second favourite. I think there was a time, even before the Huddersfield game, where I think as the local journalist, I'm sure you will know, Graham, and the Albion fans as well, knew that this could be a pivotal game for Tony. Mm-hmm. And the odds of Savan Bilic, of course, has gone since, so that's why there wasn't such a massive change in the market. But us as fans and say you as journalists knew that it was going to be such a huge game, and it proved to be, let's be honest, a really poor performance. Yeah. The fact that they were down for 10 men for over half an hour, the fact that I don't think we troubled the goalkeeper really till late on. So I think it was McLean and Phillips who had some chances in injury time, and it was such a poor performance. But as we've talked about, who else is there out there that can really... I mean, I've working in Stoke, watching Tony, what Tony did at Stoke City, the fact that he made them into a tough championship side, got promoted, took them to an FA Cup final, took them into the Europa League. I'll admit, I went to Valencia away, with Stoke, and it mm-hmm. was a it was a great experience to go out there and watch them in the Europa League. I'm sure as an Albion, well, definitely me as an Albion fan would love to have them.
Gotcha.
You know, in Europe, and just to see that. And some people will probably make comparisons now to Tony's time at Stoke then and his time at Albion now, and I tend to disagree just a little bit. Tony had been at Stoke City for a very long time. Mm-hmm. I think there are a few things off the field, a couple of personal issues that, you know, Tony, he just needed to recharge his batteries basically and just have a rest from football. He looked a tired man. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, me personally at the time, I think it was the right decision for the club to part ways. He recharged his batteries, he went to Crystal Palace, of course, and I think they were about 1-20 to be relegated Crystal Palace when Tony took over.
Mm-hmm.
And of course he got, didn't get manager of the year that year.
Did,
for keeping Crystal Palace in. As an Albion fan, I never expected him ever to take over at West Brom, just because of the stick that he used to get, because that Stoke side always used to beat Albion, and didn't Stoke fans like letting me know about that. And you look at the side, and he inherited some of the players there now. I mean, I went through it earlier. The squad he had at his disposal when he took over: Pocognoli, Brownie, Dye, Davidson, Gamboa, Samaras, Blanco, Lescott was there, admittedly, Baird, Wisdom. That's what he had to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And he steadied the ship. And we had 2 defeats against Villa, which were very tough to take, I say, as an Albion fan. But I think we finished, 13th that year. And I think he's clearly tried to build a bigger and better side, but the fact this year that he's managed to sign so many good players, that it's just, expectation has just risen a great deal, and of course results on the back of that as well, you know it hasn't helped in one little bit. Listen, as a fan, I appreciate that football isn't fantastic sometimes to watch, but as I keep saying, who I don't know, Graham, who you think, who else is out there that could possibly take over?
I think it's a really good point, though. I mean, I was listening to radio phoning the other day in which someone ardently came on and said that Craig Shakespeare and Michael Appleton should come on and replace him. I hear Craig Shakespeare name banded about quite a lot, and I think it kind of says, you know, the problem that you have, and you know, it's all well and good, all the people responding to our Twitter account saying they want Pulis out, but if Craig Shakespeare is the answer, are you asking the right question, really?
Well, listen, Shakespeare is clearly a good coach. Michael Appleton, ex-Albion, good coach. If you're an owner of a football club in Albion's current position, are you going to appoint? Are you going to take a punt in this Premier League laden full of money? Are you going to take a punt on those inexperienced as regards the manager? Are you going to take a punt on those guys keeping you in the promised land? Definitely not. That's what. I wasn't surprised to see David Moyes get the West Ham job. I'm sure he'll point to the fact that, well, I had reasons at Manchester United. I was taken over from Fergie. You know, I went to Spain and it didn't work out there. I took over at Sunderland. Look what has happened to Sunderland. He hasn't got any better since.
Mm-hmm.
And he will argue the case there. And West Ham have gone for, well, he looked at the Everton TV and thought, well, he's worth another shot. Would I have liked him at the Albion? Maybe so. But you look at Sean Dyche. Is Sean Dyche a poor man's Tony Pulis at the moment? Listen, he's Burnley side. Albion were probably quite fortunate to win at Turf Moor at the beginning of the season. But if you're looking at stats-wise, there is no way on earth that Burnley will continue in that division. They've had the least shots, one of the least shots on target in the division. They've actually conceded 56 shots on target in the division,
mm-hmm.
which is the most in the Premier League. Eventually, they are gonna fall down the league. But listen, you've got to give credit to Dyche for what he's doing, but you've got to pay £3.5 million as well, allegedly, you know, to get him out there. So you talk about Alan Pardew and people like that. I don't see him. Sam Allardyce, Dudley's finest. Could you see Sam Allardyce at the Albion?
No. It'd be quite a big jump. But then that said, as we mentioned before, I might have said the same about Tony Pulis when they started.
Yeah, listen, that's a fair point. And Sam gets some criticism. He's Bolton side I watched quite a bit of,
mm-hmm.
a number of years ago. Were very good to watch, but it just feels just the same as Tony. Sam just feels the same.
Yeah.
And if
change for change.
Yeah.
Sake.
And if Tony Pulis was to be sacked, I'm pretty damn sure if you're a manager of some of those sides down the bottom of the league who are looking to sack their manager, I'm pretty sure the first person you go to will be Tony Pulis, because he almost guarantees your safety. I know it's not great to watch at the moment. The results have been poor. expectations risen, but at the end of the day, you know, the results aren't right, and the fans, understandably so, such as the modern day fan, will question their manager. And there's no argument about that. I agree with it totally.
I think the Pulis debate is as much about what people are seeing as it is about the results that they're seeing on the pitch. And, you know, as it happens, neither are working out now. What do you think's most likely, that Tony Pulis serves up football that the Albion fans like, or that Albion replace him as a manager and they replicate Pulis' success with better football? What do you reckon?
Listen, I don't see the manager changing his philosophy after so many years. Mm-hmm. He's long in the tooth as an experienced coach. He does things his way. He will argue there's certain things have probably gone against him this year. I mean, the conceding of late goals, of late goals. Yeah. We were two up at the Watford game, two up against there. Went to Leicester where we conceded a late goal there. Southampton, we conceded a wonder goal late on. Huddersfield, there's another wonder goal. But the fans will want performances. Mm-hmm. I don't see Tony going all out gung ho attack, because he's never ever done that. He's always been pretty low on the shots on target counter, and he's also been pretty low on conceding shots on target as well. So even when we finished so high in the division, I think Sunderland, who were relegated, I think, you know, they probably took about two shots less than us, you know, all season, and conceded about 80 more. Mm-hmm. So things aren't just working out at the moment. We're conceding an awful lot of shots on target are also going in, of course, and there's a few injuries as well. Obviously, the Foster injury is a little bit, but he was injured before, wasn't he, to come back in. I'm just a little bit worried about him. Dawson being out as well, which is also a blow. And I'm not sure he doesn't know his best team. I don't think he knows his best formation at the moment, but clearly he needs to find it sooner or later, because, you know, the roar behind the crowd is going to get bigger and bigger for the manager to go.
Yeah, absolutely. Steve, thank you for coming in. You're the perfect man for the moment, really, with your with your Stoke and Albion background. So I really appreciate that.
Thank you.
So we're going to move on now to speak to a football data expert about this issue. So this is Martin Lawrence from WhoScored.com. Forgive the quality of the audio, because I was speaking to him on a mobile phone. It's not the best, but I think what you'll find what he's got to say very interesting. So, Martin, thank you ever so much for joining us. Can you diagnose the problems that Albion have been having this year so far?
Well, yeah, very much so. Like, it's quite clear, really. It's not a new thing either under any Pulis side. But obviously, the stats for possession and pass accuracy are very, very poor. They're bottom of the league for both, 40% for possession, 71% for pass accuracy. And that's all well and good. You can play a game where you don't have the ball, but you need to carry a threat in the counter, and West Brom just don't do that at the minute. They're averaging only 8.7 shots a game. Over the course of the season, that's 190 shots less than Leicester did in total when they won the league. Playing the same sort of style of relinquishing the ball, the possession of the ball to the other team, but still carrying that threat, and West Brom just don't really possess it under Pulis. It's not that they don't necessarily have the players. There's just not the same intent there. There's not the same pace to the game. So, yeah, it's not a good recipe, really.
And we were talking before about the fact that that perhaps the concerning thing about this is that Pulis teams tend to end the season well. I mean, is that something that that Albion fans should be concerned about?
Yeah, definitely. They didn't start last season too well. But they've usually got more points on the board than they do now, obviously. And the one sort of grain of hope you can take from it is that Tony Pulis does have good sort of middle sections of seasons in general. But if they don't pick up soon, there's a trend under Pulis. His second to last season at Stoke, they won one game in the last 11. His last season at Stoke, they won three in the last 18. Obviously, they failed to win in nine at the end of last season. So if they don't start getting the points on the board, there is a real threat of a relegation battle this season where there hasn't been in the past under Pulis.
And the kind of antithesis of this is, I saw someone tweet the other day to say, the obscurity of this situation is that the one person that can solve Albion's problems at the moment on paper is Tony Pulis. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's a very interesting point. There's almost a sort of, I think, throughout Pulis' career to now and in the future, there'll be the case where it's an inevitability that he will end up leaving based on the fact that he doesn't provide the sort of football that fans want to see. But it's a results business, of course it is, and he does generally, he's known to sort of ensure survival, and that's why he is sort of in a strong-ish position, despite the club not being in one, because he's one of those managers that they'll rely on to be able to sort it out. But it's a tricky situation for a board, I'd say, at this point.
And this is all about kind of having a dispassionate look at it. So you look at Albion along the lines of the kind of statistics. When you look at these statistics, can you understand why Albion fans would be unhappy about the nature of the football that they're seeing, or a great number? Yeah.
Of course, obviously West Brom are known to be a team that are sort of hard to beat at home as well, but without meaning to be too harsh, they're quite hard to lose to at home now as well. Like I said, not having much of the ball, not really carrying too much of a threat at games, it's not very entertaining. And at the end of the day, it gets to a point where fans have every right to want to be entertained, especially at home, and that's just not happening at the moment. So there needs to be a change. Whether Pulis can enforce that remains to be seen. I'm sure he'll get a bit more time to do so. He's got a decent squad there. Just there is a concern that he's had sort of what you'd consider luxury players, flair players in the past, and haven't been able to utilise them. I think the case that you've looked at more than any other is sort of Serge Gnabry, who couldn't get a kick at West Brom, and a year later he's playing for Bayern Munich. It's very understandable why West Brom fans are unhappy at the minute, I think.
Yeah, it's not the most natural of segues either, from the Albion to Bayern Munich.
So it's kind of two very different views there, really, from the world of betting. Kind of one look to say that, you know, getting rid of Tony Pulis probably makes you more likely to be relegated. A statistical look at West Bromwich Albion probably gives it a bit more downbeat view. So let's go for a third take on it now. Earlier I had a chat with Martin Spinks, who is the Stoke City correspondent for The Sentinel and someone who's worked with Tony Pulis for an awful long time. So I've had a chat about what he thinks. Here it is.
And Martin, you worked with Tony Pulis for a long time at Stoke City, 5 years in the Premier League, but several years before then. How did you find him? How did you get on with him?
A very long time, Graham. I've got to say, 99.9% of the time I got on with him fine. He's very old school in as much as he likes the local media, knows the value of them, establishes relationships, and that was great for us. He was always very conscious of what was being said about him on his behalf in the local media, would always take a keen interest. So it kept you on your toes, kept you honest, which we should be, of course. But yeah, from day to day, he was fine. The first time I actually spoke to him was a test, I think. It was 2002, and I got wind that he was going to be appointed, or could be appointed at Stoke, and he was actually driving up for the interview. But he said to me, "Please don't mention anything, because I'm just about to settle with Portsmouth, and if they find out I'm about to step into another job, it could prejudice that. So just keep it under your hat just for 12 hours. Now, I did. It was easier perhaps in those days, Graham, to keep stories under your hat. It's very difficult in the days of social media now. But I think that was perhaps a test. I don't know if it was deliberate or not, but it was a test of trust in me. And luckily I passed it, and I think that helped the relationship I had with him.
So it sounds like you got on with him pretty well. Can you think back to your time with him? Have you got any particular stories of your experiences with him?
He would occasionally ring up when he wasn't happy about something. I remember once a story by Adi Akinbaye, who was struggling a bit, going through a bit of a lean patch. I can't remember the precise mechanics of the story, but he felt it was putting a bit of pressure on his players. So he was always very protective of his players. Anything that was written or said about the players that would undermine them or put pressure on them and therefore affect their performance on a match day, he was always very conscious of that, always very protective of the people that were playing for him. But I say that those sort of incidents were few and far between. You know, we got on pretty well, mainly because for the most part the team were doing well. Not so much in the first spell. He came under a lot of fire from fans during the first spell, and certainly they didn't all want him back when he came back for his second time at the club in 2006. But obviously, after a rocky start then, he got the club up and running and eventually got them promoted. With the baggage, of course.
I suppose the to a certain extent he's had a similar history with the Albion fans, which just been a bit more kind of squashed together. You know, he was with Stoke a long time, but because of he had promotion, I think that sort of bought him time in terms of the kind of attritional football he paid. It probably bought him a bit more time. You know, there was a couple of years before the Premier League and 5 years in the Premier League, but it started to go sour towards the end. I mean, can you talk us how did it end with Tony Pulis at Stoke?
It ended in 2013. The club had been in the Premier League 5 years. They were actually, I just checked on the record actually, just to make absolutely sure, the Boxing Day of that last season, they beat Liverpool at home 3-1 and were eighth in the table. And people were talking about the Europa League again. They'd reached the Europa League via losing the FA Cup final in 2011. But here we were thinking, well, it's possible to get in there on merit, in inverted commas, through the league position. They were going that well. But they then went on a run of just one win in 14 games into the new year, January, February, March time. And I can always remember a 4-0 home defeat by Chelsea, Graham, when Chelsea were obviously pretty hot that day. And I remember poor old John Walters, who was a typical Tony Pulis player, you know, blood and thunder, would give everything for the cause. And he scored two own goals that day and missed a penalty. Just a horrendous day, one of those days where he just couldn't do anything right. And that was typical of Stoke in that run. And, you know, we were actually starting to sweat a bit. Relegation was looming, and then the fifth game from the end of the season, they went to QPR. And it really was a critical turning point. They ended up winning the game 2-0. And then I think they got something like 5 points out of the last four games and finished 13th. But there was no doubt for a long time they were rocking during that season. But what emerged later, I knew this, those close to him knew this, but it was never made public at the time. Before that last season started, his daughter gave birth to his first grandchild and she tragically died 3 or 4 weeks old. And that was kept from the public view, but obviously those around him, the board knew. And it was interesting that later on, after he'd left Stoke, Tony was quoted as saying that he may even have been guilty of taking his eye off the ball, which is unlike Tony, as Albion fans will well know. Mm-hmm. But that's the effect that death had on him, understandably, of course. And I think that was all playing in the minds possibly of the board. So it wasn't just results orientated, but the results certainly counted against Tony in the second half of that season. And if the board were in any doubt, maybe those results twisted their arm. And at the end of that season, there was a parting of the ways.
It's interesting because I would say the pressure that's on Tony Pulis is almost entirely because of the nature of performance rather than the results. You know, I don't think Albion fans expect to never be flirting with relegation, but they aren't prepared to flirt with relegation watching, you know, football where they're only getting one or two chances in any game because really six people are ostensibly playing in defence. I mean, did the pressure come to bear in the end for Stoke to become more adventurous even in the Premier League? Or was it really a results thing that did for him at Stoke?
Well, there was that pressure. There was always a small section of support, which was varying sizes, but small for most of the time in the Premier League, that would always complain about the performances. And obviously he had this reputation, and still has it to this day, of being very defensively minded. And there were periods when football was a bit attritional, as you say, but they were grinding out results. And in the early days, they were an underdog in the Premier League, so that was okay. The fans accepted that. But as time goes on, as with any club, they want a bit more, not just results, not just escaping relegation or sitting pretty in mid-table. They want a bit of entertainment as well. He did bring players in, players like Tunçay, the Turkish international, Aydegerd Johnson, Charlie Adam, you know, flair players, for want of a better phrase. But he wasn't always able to graft them into the team, and they weren't always able to give him what he wanted, which was not just the flair side of it, but the effort as well. And they couldn't always deliver that, so they didn't always get a game, and that of course provided ammunition for those who wanted to see entertainment and wanted to see more skillful players. They'd say, well, why is Tunçay sitting on the bench? Why is Good Johnson not getting a game? Another one was Michael Owen, who came in for what proved to be his last season in football, and Tony kept protecting him by saying he's trying to get him fit, he's not quite fit enough. I think the bottom line with Michael Owen is he probably was past it by that point. But he could not be accused of not trying to bring in bigger names, better players. Didn't always work, but often did.
I was going to say, one of the things that leads me to something I wanted to ask you about is I wonder if that throws up a question about his ability to bring better players into the team. I sort of remember at Stoke that he was bringing better players like Tunçay and someone, but
but he seemed to regress to the original team, the Rory Delaps and so on, and he struggled to bring in better players. And we're sort of in that place now where he's struggling to make the team play better. Is it a problem for Tony Pulis to bring in a better class of player and move teams on, do you think?
Well, I don't think he'll ever compromise on having a strong defensive side. He'll always build from that basis, whether he can get the players around that. He will always buy, or has always bought, defenders. You know, that possibly, well, the greatest central defensive partnership here at Stoke during the Premier League years has been Ryan Shawcross and Robert Huth, neither of whom would claim to be any kind of Franz Beckenbauer, but boy, they were and are good defenders. And I know Tony's often been accused of playing four centre-backs, and I think he has done that, hasn't he, at Albion on occasions.
Oh, God, yeah.
Across the back four, yeah. So he'll never apologise for that, in having a strong defence. So that places a lot of strain on the midfield. If he can have a midfield defend and attack, he's then got a launching pad to have a good attack inside as well. And he had that at Stoke for a long period by playing players like John Walters, who weren't everybody's cup of tea, but he'd run all day, get stuck in, and he could score goals. Matthew Etherington. Now, people looked at him and thought, well, he's never going to be a Stoke player. But again, Tony Pulis got him working. I've never seen a wing work so hard. But when he got into attacking areas, boy, could he cross the ball for people like James Beattie, Ricardo Fuller and what have you. He will get flair players into the team, but he won't upset the balance. He won't compromise the balance of having a strong defensive base at the same time. I don't think he'll ever tip the balance that way, as some managers do, and he can all unravel very quickly. He'd never want to get himself into that situation.
And let's say it's some fans, a lot of fans that are calling for Tony Pulis' head get their way. What can Albion expect? Let's say Tony Pulis goes. You've been through this experience. I sort of get the impression that from afar, he's a difficult manager a difficult act to follow. You know, if you look at Albion, I mean, they've actually finally signed a couple of fullbacks, but he doesn't tend to buy them. So I mean, you've got a team that's very tailored to what he wants to do. I mean, is that been the story at Stoke? Has it been difficult for Mark Hughes to follow Tony Pulis?
I think timing's everything with a change of manager. And obviously it was at the end of the season, which gives the new manager time. They finished 13th, so they weren't a poor team. And he came in with the brief that he was going to improve the football. And he played that down, but that's what he did. And he brought players in to try and do that. I mean, he brought players that Tony Pulis probably would never have brought to Stoke, like Marko Arnautović, later on Jurdan Shaqiri. And there's no doubt that the style of play did change. I hesitate to use the word improve. I think that's perhaps a bit insulting on Tony Pulis, but there will be fans who say the style of play improved, and certainly fans on the outside as well. But Mark Hughes never got away from the core values of a good, strong team through the middle. And they were, for many years, Tony Pulis players still that were through the middle of the team. He never got away from that and was perhaps wise not to. He knew that Pulis had left him a strong base to build from and bring in flair players around that base, and that's what he did successfully for a good 2 or 3 years. It's only in the last 12 months, 18 months, that perhaps Mark Hughes has begun to struggle.
So if anything, I mean, the opposite of what I suggested might be the case. I mean, one thing you know is that everyone's drilled, they know how to defend set pieces and so on, and if anything, maybe Hughes had profited from that for a while.
Absolutely. I mean, let's say Tony went tomorrow, any manager coming in would know he's got a group of players that can defend. And that gives him something to build from. Whether he lets the brakes off a bit with other players, I don't know, James McClain, maybe that kind of player, gives them more game time. Because I noticed he was on the bench, wasn't he, last week?
Yeah.
You know, a new manager might do that. He might just say, loosen the brakes a bit. That would be his decision. But he would know he'd have a strong defensive base to build from.
And you're probably the best placed UK journalist to answer this question. Do you think Tony Pulis will ever get relegated?
Unlikely, and that's not a coincidence. It's because of what we've just been talking about. He can build a team that's difficult to beat, and there are those that say that's where he thrives. And I remember joking with him when he was out of work once. I said, "Well, why don't you just leave whatever job you're in at the end of the season, put your feet up till November, and then when the team's struggling, put your hand up, go in there for 6 months." Earn a bit of money, earn a nice bonus, keep them up, and just keep doing that for a few years. Because he is a firefighting manager. He did that at Stoke in his first spell here, I remember, kept them up in the Championship on the last day. So that's, I still think that's where he really thrives. But that doesn't mean to say he can't manage a team that finishes in the top half of the Premier League. And I know he's been trying to prove that at West Brom.
So there it is. The issue of Tony Pulis continues to be a divisive one. The research that we did on social media suggests that there's an awful lot of Albion fans are unhappy at the moment, but he's still got a lot of fans out there in the football world. We'll leave it for you really to decide what you think should happen with him. Just for this week, we thought we'd bring it to you and bring a plethora of opinions here. Next week's Woodman Corner podcast will be a bit of a return to the norm, really. We are a storytelling podcast. We're about getting people to tell their stories about West Bromwich Albion, their highs, their lows, the things they enjoyed and so on. Next week we have another footballer telling you some stories from the dressing room that you've never heard before, so be sure to tune in, and thank you again for joining us at Woodman Corner.